You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we're in historic downtown Santa Ana. The music is bumping. The locals are tearing it up at the skate park spread out across the cobblestone promenade.
If you're not here, you're missing out.
That's J.J. Hamilton, one of dozens of skaters out here on this sunny Saturday afternoon. Some days you'll catch him tearing it up on his skateboard, but on others, like today, he's riding another board at a teeny tiny skate park.
Feels like the same. It's just certain tricks on my fingers I can't do on my feet because I broke my ankles in the years in the past, but I don't know, to me it's the same. It's the same popping for ollies is the same as popping with your feet.
Yep, you heard that right. Popping ollies with his fingers. Today on Greater LA, we're talking about miniature skateboards that you can ride using just two fingers. They're called, as you would imagine, fingerboards. And there's a thriving fingerboarding scene right here in SoCal. And it's part of an international and not to mention lucrative community. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo picks up the story from here.
Today, dear listener, we're posted up at the Slush Cult Mini Mart, a neon pink, orange, and green-colored mecca of all things fingerboarding. Specialty wheels, decks, snacks, and more are all crammed into the small 200-square-foot store. But on days like today, the Mini Mart spills out onto the promenade outside. We're at the latest fingerboarding sesh, where skaters of all ages cram around skate parks the size of a dining room table, full of tiny handrails, ramps, plants, and even sidewalks. And they're all showing off their latest tricks on boards the size of your palm. Here's Clayton McCarthy. He's the owner of the Slush Cult Mini Mart.
The way that I would explain it to someone who doesn't fingerboard is like, imagine taking a skateboard and like a shrink ray gun, and you literally shoot the skateboard with a shrink ray gun.
If you're wondering how this fingerboarding thing works, think of it this way. Instead of using your legs and feet to do tricks, like on a skateboard, you use two fingers placed on top of the board. And through sheer patience, determination, and dexterity, you can master virtually every skateboarding trick you can think of, from the relative safety of a desk, mini park, or whatever flat surface is in arm's reach. Nearby, Shamir Ali is towering above a fingerboard park. It's painted slate gray, and miniature stairs and ramps lead into a deep graffitied bowl. He's concentrating hard, trying to catch some air with this fingerboard and land a kickflip without wiping out.
Why are you laughing?
It brings me a lot of joy, honestly.
Yeah?
It's kind of crazy. I didn't think I'd be so into it, but then it's like became like a huge habit after a while. Yeah, love it.
Shamir's been fingerboarding for the last 2 years, and initially, it was a pandemic lockdown hobby. He found his old tech deck from grade school in a box. And tech decks were all the rage in the late 90s and early 2000s. They were the first popular fingerboards, mass-produced and made out of cheap plastic.
I probably was like the worst kid in school. I had like 20 of them, and I just keep buying more.
Shamir got back in touch with his childhood pastime, and he eventually discovered the Slush Cult Mini Mart.
And then I went to see it in person. I was like, wow, this is like more of a, I don't know, it's more of a crew, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a lifestyle, right? And plus the fingerboard quality is like really sick. So it's like definitely upgraded from like a normal tech deck to something else.
Boards for your fingers have actually been on the skate scene since the 1960s and 1970s, when amateur skaters crafted them out of cardboard and parts of toy cars. But many of today's fingerboards are works of handcrafted art. Slush Cult Mini Mart owner Clayton says the good ones are made almost exactly like regular skateboards, a deck with five layers of maple wood, glued and pressed, with graphics on the bottom.
These wheels even have little tiny bearings in, and like, you know, you can hear them. They spin just like a real skateboard wheel, sometimes even better than a real skateboard wheel, and they're made out of the same urethane that a skateboard is made out of.
By the way, these fingerboards don't come cheap. Sure, you can still hop on over to Target and pick up a flimsy tech deck for about 10 bucks, but these handcrafted beauties?
Just how, you know, a professional skateboard with an expensive deck, expensive trucks, expensive wheels, expensive grip tape can run you anywhere from like 120 to 160 bucks. The same thing can happen within fingerboarding.
As fingerboards have grown up over the last 50 years, so has the sport itself. 27-year-old Nash Hawkes grew up in the small town of Visalia in the San Joaquin Valley, messing around with tech decks and selling custom boards to his friends.
You know, selling them on break, selling them in between classes. Black market of fingerboards, tech decks in middle school.
Eventually, he made his way into competition. Many fingerboarding contests follow the same general rules. Nail a certain number of tricks in a set time, sometimes live, sometimes in an unedited video, and judges pick a winner. This past year, Nash won one of the biggest competitions of them all, the USA Fingerboarding National Championship, hosted by USA Skateboarding.
I just came back from Europe on an 11-day tour for the online world championships. I was a judge and then shooting a catalog for Black River.
Black River is a German-based company founded back in 1999 and is arguably the biggest fingerboarding company in the world. It's also one of his biggest sponsors. Today, Nash has his own company called Sorry for Fingerboarding, and you could say he's a pretty big deal.
Kids would make the connection at the contest. Like, I'm not always trying to go around like, oh yeah, that's me, but like, they would look and look again at me, look at the catalog, look again at me. And then like, oh, that's you. Like, yep. And then like, they're signing it for them. They're asking.
Over the years, Nash has gone on sponsored fingerboarding tours around the country and even the world. To Dallas, Denver, Berlin, even Portugal. Unlike Nash or Clayton, Sofia Maddaleno didn't grow up playing around with tech decks in the middle of math class. At just 15 years old, she's become part of the next generation of fingerboarders. She's even got a handful of sponsors.
And I am sponsoring one of three companies, Moods USA on Instagram, Organic Fingerboards, and Recycled Ramps. And send me free stuff. I support them. They support me.
Just like in skateboarding, there are more visible men than women in fingerboarding. And in fact, today, at the Slush Cult fingerboarding sesh, she was the only girl who rolled up. But Sophia, she doesn't care. All that's on her mind is landing the tricks and having fun in the process.
When you're really deep in a trick, you can either get really, really frustrated over yourself, or you can get almost this really calm feeling that you get and just trying the trick over and over again. And once you land it, it's like the best feeling ever. You've been trying for so long, and then you finally get it. It's one of the most rewarding feelings.
As fingerboarding attracts the next generation of riders, it could be experiencing a bit of a renaissance. Data on the number of fingerboarders out there is slim, but companies like Burger King and Red Vines featured fingerboards in massive ad campaigns just last month. And recently, Tony Hawk, you know, the most famous skateboarding pioneer, just unveiled his own line of fingerboards. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguaya.
All right, we're going to roll on with the program. Coming up on GLA, an expanded anti-camping ordinance makes it to the finish line at City Hall. How much harm might it do to the unhoused? More on that on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. This morning, the LA City Council got an earful.
Members, we're going to take a short recess. Please head to the back.
Okay. For members
Sergeant,
of the audience,
clear the room.
In case you can't hear, we're taking a recess while this is being taken care of.
Those are the voices of protesters in the council chambers this morning, along with Council President Nuri Martinez and a representative of the City Attorney's Office. The protesters oppose an expansion of L.A. Municipal Code 4118. That's the ordinance that makes it illegal for people to sit, sleep, or lie in many parts of the city. Well, sometimes referred to as the anti-camping ordinance, 4118 has had a long and fraught history in L.A. with unhoused Angelenos and advocates claiming that it unfairly targets those who live outside or in tents. And despite today's raucous protest, during which at least one person was detained, council members did vote to further expand the law prohibiting unhoused people from setting up tents within 500 feet of all of L.A.'s schools and daycare centers. Adam Mahoney is a reporter for Capital B News, recently dug into the complicated, very complicated history and the implementation of 4118 and why it often winds up affecting black Angelenos the most. Adam, thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
So 4118 has been in the books in L.A. since 1963. Can you talk about what this measure does exactly and how it has evolved?
Yeah, so when it was first passed in the early 60s, it started out as an anti-loitering law. But over the last couple of decades, it has transformed with the homelessness crisis in the city of Los Angeles. And last year, it was amended by the council to fully incorporate what you called the anti-camping ordinance, making it illegal to sit, lie, or sleep in about 100 different sections of the city. And today, the council is voting to amend that amendment to make it more than 2,000 sites across the city.
The latest expansion will put even more off limits, right? I mean, so how were the unhoused people that you talked to for your story feeling about even the possibility of that?
Yeah, it was a mixed bag of responses, you know, because there were some folks who didn't even know that 4118 existed, right? That doesn't mean they weren't interacting with police or county and city representatives. They just didn't have the language around the ordinance. But there were definitely folks who, you know, have had and been put in situations where they've been constantly interacting with the police and constantly been pushed around the city because of the ordinance. I actually live in the harbor area of LA, so Wilmington and Harbor City, where a couple of those sites are already implemented. And I've talked to at least two unhoused folks who have experienced being pushed around as a result, but not necessarily offered any supportive housing.
Well, that's the thing, right? In order to be pushed out or swept, they have to be offered some, at least shelter, right?
You would think, but there are not enough beds for the amount of people that we have on the streets right now. So there are folks who, you know, can go months, years without being offered anything while living on the streets.
LA isn't the only city that contends with an ordinance like this. This is obviously a problem that affects many big cities across the country. How are these ordinances, these anti-camping ordinances, playing out in other parts of the country?
Yeah, there are, I think, about at least nine different bills across the country that have been introduced that mimic the city of Los Angeles's ordinance. The biggest is probably in Austin, which passed their bill last year. And in the year since they passed it, homelessness and tents in the city have actually increased. So the ordinance is not necessarily getting to the root causes of these issues, rather just pushing them around the city into places where they can be, quote unquote, disappeared, to use the language of advocates and activists.
You mentioned that black people make up nearly 45% of L.A.'s unhoused population, though only about 8% of L.A. residents are black. That's a striking disparity. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, as a black Angeleno myself, on the younger side, I've seen the remnants of, you know, racist housing and discriminatory housing policies that have placed us in the position we are today. So when you think of redlining or exclusionary zoning and subprime mortgages more recently in the fallout of the 2008 housing crisis, it's just been whiplash after whiplash of black folks in the city losing their access to affordable and safe housing. And the story we laid out, you know, a kind of a timeline going from the second great migration when black folks really began to settle in the city in the 1940s and 50s, and how because of redlining and black folks being pushed into the city's, you know, quote unquote, disadvantaged and environmentally toxic communities, how that impacted not only health, but also access to jobs throughout the city, right? Because, you know, if you're living in South LA, you're poor, you don't have access to a car, it's hard to travel to some of these job centers and where, you know, the economic power in the city actually is.
One of the people that you talked to for this story, a guy named Damian Wilson, compared the racial disparities that he saw in the homeless population to those that he saw in prison. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I wonder, because you've got this over the course of decades in this country, the war on drugs and, you know, mass incarceration. How does that feed on all of this, do you think?
Yeah, it's all deeply intertwined. If we think of Damien specifically, after he was incarcerated for 2 decades, one of the reasons why he lost his housing is because he, because of his record, wasn't able to move in to housing as an individual, right? And he had to come in with a roommate, and he got into a struggle with his roommate, ended up being pushed out of that housing and not having access to something else because of his record. And when we think of, you know, just the fallout of incarceration, so not being able to access jobs, the economy in the same way, of course that's going to intertwine and limit your access to housing and all the different things that we need to survive.
And when you tie it back into the, you know, what we're talking about, 4118, anti-camping, you know, more Black people living outside means they're increasingly susceptible to being policed in one way or another. Some sort of encounter could become violent. What do you say to that? And how does that get fixed, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of advocates believe that not only does the policing compound this crisis, but if you were able to, you know, siphon off some of those resources that are put into policing and given to folks directly, whether that be job training or supportive housing, that it would take the need away from policing, right? In the city of LA, you know, data backs this up. Nearly half of all police calls are for unhoused folks. Roughly 1/3 of all use of force incidents are against unhoused residents. A large portion of our policing resources are being put into this crisis when there are ways where we can intervene and not even need that.
It's certainly an important point, and it's an important story. I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us, Adam. Adam Mahoney, a reporter for Capital B News. Adam, thanks.
Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. One flashpoint more than a year ago in the crisis of the unhoused was a large encampment around Echo Park Lake that was swept by the city with the mostly unfulfilled promise of finding those folks shelter or housing. A fence that the city erected when it was quote-unquote renovating the park was up for more than a year until last weekend. Apparently someone or some folks took the fencing down and hoisted a sign that reads, "Welcome to People's Park, L.A. Well, regardless of what happened and what's happening at Echo Park Lake, there are still people, mostly of the neighborhood, who want to keep things clean and trash-free, while at the same time saying they are respectful of the folks who live on the sidewalks and grass. The Echo Park Trash Club is a group of volunteers that gather a couple of Sundays a month to do just that, collect trash. And Erin Fine is the founder of the group. She's with us right now. Hi, Erin.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start off with the club itself. What motivated you to start doing this?
I think it was a variety of things, but it was in 2020 and it was the height of the pandemic. And I noticed as I walked around my neighborhood, Echo Park, that the trash buildup was increasing. It had been a problem or just, you know, something we were struggling with in our neighborhood for a while. But it was really increasing during the pandemic. And I'm originally from the Midwest. I also spent a long time living in Brooklyn. And when I moved to LA, I really yearned for more of a sense of community. And so I used social media to try to learn a little bit more about folks living in my neighborhood. I started using the Nextdoor app to begin with. And so it began by an effort to get to know my neighbors and find out if people would like to work on trash collection with me.
So you're talking about picking up trash. Is it from trash cans, overfilled cans, you know, stuff on the sidewalks, in front of businesses, things like that, in front of homes?
Well, there is sort of a journey that the group has been on. It started just as this kind of very small neighborhood initiative, and we started by just working on streets And what I have started calling microtrash, small pieces of litter, cigarette butts, you know, anything that gets kind of tossed out of car windows. As the group grew, we were, with a lot of effort, we were able to coordinate getting a city trash truck to come to our events. And when that started, we wanted to start serving encampment areas.
You've been doing this a couple of years now. Did you start off with this mission?
No, it started out as just a small neighborhood trash pickup group. But when we were able to work with a trash truck, so we were able to work on large amounts of trash, that's when we decided, hey, let's go see if we can help the encampment areas.
What's been your biggest challenge to date?
Well, one of the big challenges is that if you imagine an encampment area like an apartment area, and if you think about the type of trash buildup that occurs just on a normal week, and then imagine that there was no trash servicing for that house or that apartment, imagine what that would look like. It would very quickly build up into large piles of trash. And so one of our challenges is that because there is not very much city trash servicing for encampment areas, it's difficult to keep up with the amount of trash that occurs. Another complication is that because of the way sweeps have been handled, there's a lot of mistrust in the unhoused community and just a lot of fear. And it's taken us some time to build trust in our neighborhood that what we do is distinctly different from that.
You're not concerned, though, because there's an LA city sanitation truck involved, that it looks like a sweep?
We are concerned about that, but that is why we work so hard to have conversations and explain the situation. And I think because we visit the same encampment areas, we've now been able to set up a trusting situation. We see people that we've worked with before, but we did have to make our intentions really clear. So it's something we're working on. We would love it if we could have a trash truck that was painted a completely different color and had like rainbows and suns and hearts on it, and that we could have like a community truck, but that's not something we've been able to achieve just yet. So, you know, but it's something we're able to do, which just goes to show you that, you know, just speaking with people just the same way you and I are speaking, it really goes a long way.
So if other people want to get involved in this effort, how do they do that?
Yeah, there are many ways you can get involved. I would say our main hub is on Instagram these days. So you can visit at Echo Park Trash Club on Instagram. There's an underscore between each word. And we have a website, we have a newsletter, and it's now being run really collectively by a group of members. So it's an awesome opportunity to make friends. So we would love to have you if you're interested in coming to work with us.
Erin Fine, founder of the Echo Park Trash Club. Erin, thanks for your time and thanks for all you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow in North Hollywood, the biggest concentration of live theaters was hit hard by the pandemic. What's the scene like there now? Off to NoHo we go tomorrow on GLA. Always online at our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what's on your mind. Maybe there's a story idea you have. Sign up for the podcast, too, all at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. And, of course, get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Rebecca Ludman, Ted Robbins, Jay Siebold, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped in this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and your ears. Have yourself a great evening.